What's up, everybody? Jeff, Dennis, and myself, we'll be back with a new episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast later this week. Due to the great success of the Rooftop Oath 2 weekends ago in San Antonio, we have a whole new batch of listeners, and so I thought they'd probably come to the website checking us out. So why not represent them with the episode that was basically the beginning of what became the Rooftop Oath. So for those of you who are new, who discovered us in San Antonio, Texas, welcome to the show. That's my Roomba banging on the door. Don't worry about that. We're not being invaded. It's a Sunday. I got housework going on. But anyhow, without any further ado, welcome to the show. And here's the episode that was responsible for what became the Rooftop Oath. There it goes again. For what became the Rooftop Oath, episode 208. Of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. Thank you guys so much, and we'll talk to y'all next week.
Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast, and we have a good show for you tonight. But real quick, before we get to that, I just want to remind y'all, thank you for your continued support of the podcast. We are growing. We see it. We're getting the emails. You know, Dennis, I feel that sometimes we forget the mail call. We don't mention it enough. We oftentimes forget it. And so we have new fans who don't know. If you want to reach out to us, send us an email. Mail call at yes. WTSPWorldWar2.com. That's WTSPWWII.com. Send us anything. Thoughts, complaints, suggestions. Perhaps Absolutely. There's a topic like young Andrew here, which we're going to introduce shortly, who has something he wants to share. Something he says, hey, I got this really cool information. I know I can talk about it for an hour because I got a passion for it. Let me come on and share with the audience. And we're like, what? An episode we don't have to do research? Come on down. You're the next contestant on What's the Scuttlebutt. So if you are that way, look, we've talked. Jeff and I have talked about it. One of the great things about living history in World War II is we cannot explain why little things bite onto us. I can't explain to you why I have 17 canteens in my garage. It's just a thing I like. I can't explain why I have 7-in-1 helmets surrounding me. It's just a thing I like. Jeff loves planes. Dennis has his own thing. Andrew has his own thing. So if you have your own thing, bring it to the show. Email us at mailcall at WTSPWorldWar2.com. And after you send that email, stay on our website or head over to our website. Click on the Patreon link, sign up, and subscribe. At the end of this month, we're giving away this. See that yellow shirt? And across the top of every single page, some poor intern at the publishing house had to stamp every single page with a rubber stamp that says not for resale. So we're going to give this away at the end of the month. All you have to do is be an active subscriber. Doesn't matter which tier, the dollar, the $3, the $750 a month. Sign up and subscribe at the end of the month. All active subscribers, except for the person who won last time, because that wouldn't be fair, is entered in to win this book, and we'll send you some stickers as well. And last plug, YouTube.com, D410 Media. You can find our content. We're slowly uploading short and video versions of our podcast so you guys can see who we're talking to. And without any further ado, Dennis, why don't you take it away?
Yeah, sure. You know, exactly what you were talking about. Please send in your emails, messages. Like, we want to know what's on your mind. And the guest we have tonight is a direct result of that call out, you know. And one thing that we're all very passionate about as historians and, you know, impressionists of World War II is making sure that, and one thing I really enjoy is that we all have the same mindset on this, all three of us, is making sure that we're doing everything we can to bring along the next generation of historians who are in their 20s and early 30s, who are just as passionate, and they've got subjects that they've latched onto. So, we don't want the history to disappear. And the young man we're having tonight is going to make sure that one facet of that is definitely not going to be disappear. And one, it's such a unique story, and I'm really excited about it. It's actually takes place just south of me. And so I got to talk to Andrew and on the phone. We had a nice conversation that night, and I was super impressed. Yeah, this is a young man who has done his homework, and you are going to see that tonight. So, Andrew, thank you. Thank you so much for...
Absolutely. And Don and Dennis, I can't thank you enough for letting me hop on tonight. It's an honor to be on your podcast. I'm sure avid World War II fan listens to this. I know I'm guilty of it sometimes at work when I got a slow or busy day. I turn this on and I listen to it. It makes a day go by faster. And you guys have a wide range of topics that it never gets old. So thank you very much.
Well, I greatly appreciate that, and we appreciate you coming on. You know the format, so before we get into the topic, why don't you explain to our audience how you kind of got bit by the history bug and how this particular topic found its way to you and what drove you to find out more information to lead you to where we are today?
Absolutely. So I grew up on a 7-generation family farm in the Lower Peninsula of Michigan. And ever since I was a kid, I don't know if people would let their kids do this now, but my dad was a very big history fan. My vacations were never to the beach or, you know, all that. We were tromping Civil War battlefields when I was a kid. And then
a Michigander can only go to Cedar Point so many times.
Exactly. Yeah. And I probably been to Gettysburg probably 20 times or more. I was bit by that bug at an early age. My first movies that I watched when I was a kid, Saving Private Ryan, The Patriot, you know, it's like, I don't know about today, but I really enjoyed that stuff. And so I remember, you know, my entrance as a kid was Band of Brothers and like Saving Private Ryan, you know, so all I knew was the European theater. My great grandfather served with an ordnance company in Europe. I never got to meet him, but he died about 38 years before I was born. So my dad never knew him, but we had a box of his stuff growing up. It was all of his war medals. He had PTSD when he got out of the war, kind of rough life. And it doesn't take away from what he did, but you know, his stuff was pushed to the side. And my dad, like I said, was big into history. So he got that stuff. And we reconnected with that side of the family. We had all of his war letters, and it showed what kind of person he was. Just a down to earth, oldest of 13 type guy, and just a great story. And so where I got into this was when the Pacific miniseries came out, which I know you guys are well versed on with Mr. Sledge being a part of your show and whatnot. But when that came out, I was like, you know, there's another side of this war here. And so I looked for everything Pacific related. I was in the sixth grade at the time, and Flags of Our Fathers came across my radar, and I instantly was infatuated with that story. And just James Bradley did a fantastic job getting, you know, to know the key characters there and whatnot. And I couldn't tell you what got me to Harlan Black, the figure at the far end base of the pole, but he grew up on a farm like I did. He played football. I'm a big football guy, played in high school, and it was a smaller town in Texas from what my research states. And I grew up in a very small town. I graduated with 57 kids. And so we had a connection like that. And so that, I would say, the long story short, that I saw a lot of similarities there. And I always wanted to write a book about him. I couldn't tell you why, because, you know, there's been a lot written on the subject. But you know, there's been some changes in the flag raising picture and whatnot, but at the end, to cap this all off, during the pandemic, my cousin was working down in Corpus Christi as a welding inspector, and I was home from Michigan State University, and my aunt and myself and went to visit him, and they took me down to Weslaco in February of 2021. And I kept seeing these 8 guys everywhere that everywhere I went. And I'm like, I want to know about these 8 teammates here. And so that's what led me to this story.
I think it's a perfect segue to go right into the story that you sent us, the beautifully presented PowerPoint. And I'm going to figure out a way to put that up on our website where people can watch it in real time instead of downloading the
Yeah. And so, and if we want to have a discussion about it too, it, like I said, I'm good with whatever. But the picture here, this, it's titled the Westaco 8, and we'll dive into why they were called that, you know, from their hometown. But they were 8 high school football teammates that joined the Marines together during World War II. So this picture here, obviously, is Texas, and Dennis is from there. So if I say anything wrong, I wasn't born in Texas. So if I make a mistake, let me know. But Westaco, Texas is located right down at the base there in what they call the Rio Grande Valley of Texas. It was founded in 1919, and by 1940 had a population of nearly 7,000. And a lot of these guys that we're about to talk about here, they didn't grow up there. Well, they grew up there, but they weren't born there. They kind of migrated there from the 1920s after the Depression into that area. It was very heavily agriculture, and especially like citrus, cotton, and cattle were some of the big three. And I can't thank the Westaco Museum enough. They've really have supported this project, and I've asked thousands. I'm sure you guys, you're all involved in the history world. I've asked thousands upon thousands of questions, and they always respond. So I appreciate that. So we're, yep, next slide. And so we'll introduce you to the 8 really quick, and I'll make it short and sweet. But this guy here, Edward Pete Hall, he was not the oldest of the 8, but he was, in terms of school, he was a year ahead of the rest of these guys. So he had graduated the year before in 1942. And I'm not sure if you guys have a football background, but he was a offensive lineman, and he was a co-captain on the team before. But their team wasn't very good. Their team, they were in a rebuilding season, and they only won 2 games. And one of the teams that they played was Mission, Texas. And the quarterback was Tom Landry.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
And he beat him pretty bad. He was a good player, which we probably know now.
By all accounts, was football at the level, because we all know of West Texas football and a love for football, but back in the 20s and 30s, was it even higher held esteem because of lack of entertainment around, or was it just kind of growing in its fanaticism throughout Texas at that time?
That's what that's what I've come to the conclusion. I mean, I wrote a small little book about my high school football team back in the day, and I was surprised at how well the newspapers covered this. I can tell you right now that if it wasn't for newspapers.com, I wouldn't have found any of this. They have the box scores, the game by game, who scored touchdowns. It was insane. I could not believe it.
Yeah, it was huge back in those days.
Yep. Yeah,
even on my grandpa's ship, I've got letters from Byron Yarbrough and Leo Bedell, the two officers, going back and forth about the SEC. Who's better, Auburn, you know, Ohio State, you know. So, yeah, it was huge.
Yeah, and when they found out, when Pearl Harbor happened, these guys were at a Texas football game on December 7th, 1941. They did an annual, from what I learned, they did an annual trip to Texas Stadium up there, and I believe it was Texas versus Oregon. I'd have to go back through my book there, but they were at the game when they found out that the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. So
now he's the oldest of 7. Did Ryan? Did he have any?
We haven't gotten brothers? Into Ryan yet. He introduced the first slide. He's getting ready to introduce Ryan now.
Yep, and so Leo Ryan here, yep, he was the oldest of 7 sons. He did have a brother that was still alive during my interview process, and I did receive a letter from him about just, you know, some brief information. He has since passed. But Leo was from Oklahoma. He might, like I said, he was one of the many that migrated south to West Texas. So, yep. We're good there. Of course, the one of the famous ones here, Harlan Black. He was born in Yorktown, Texas, which is in DeWitt County. He moved to the McAllen, Westaco area when he was an infant. And I'm sure if you've read Flags of Our Fathers, he grew up in a very strict Seventh-day Adventist home. His mother was very serious about the religion there, and he went to Valley Grande Academy up until he was a sophomore, when he was expelled because from all accounts he wouldn't rat out on who vandaled the local outhouse. So he transferred to Westlake High School as a junior, never played sports before, and he earned honorable mention All Valley as a junior. And made a few key plays in his junior season. So he had a pretty good, sounds like a natural athlete.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about him.
Yep.
Now, Desmond Doss, he was a Seventh-day Adventist, wasn't he?
Yep.
Now, but Harlan Block, he's going on and he's in an, you know, you're saying his parents, or mom was very,
yep.
So how is he reconciling being a Marine Corps parachute, you know, parachutist?
Yeah. And so from what I've thought about too, I think it was that his buddies all went in together, I think was what I found out. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to really interview many of Harlan's family, and I don't want to go against anything that they may know, but I think a lot of it, if I had to guess, you know, all of his best friends were going in, and so I think that's probably my guess.
Well, so it was more of his mom's religion than his.
Yeah, and I think all the kids were, from what I've understood, I think, because he was the third of six, I know for a fact that one of his brothers did graduate from Westlake and played football, one of his younger brothers, but I think the rest of them all graduated from the Adventist school.
Well, I think we can all kind of take from our own life experiences. You can go to any church and pick 15 people, and all 15 of them will have a different level of their version of religion and,
for sure,
and how they're going to participate in that religion's guidelines and how seriously.
Yeah, but that's unique though, because that's a cult. We would, you know, consider that a cult.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I should say too, I did have, and it's in my files over here too, I did interview like a distant cousin of his, and I believe Harlan's dad was a conscientious objector in the First World War. I believe that he went in because he worked in the medical corps.
Yeah,
so
checks out, because that's what Doss did.
Yep.
Sorry for...
No, that's great. Great discussion. Next we have Glenn Kleckler, who we'll refer to a lot. He moved to Westlake as a child as well and grew up on a farm. He was a three-year varsity player, and I'm sure if you guys know that's pretty big when it comes to sports. Mostly you're guaranteed 2 years on varsity, but Kleckler was a three-year player, and he was very well known in school. The school had a local newspaper as well, and he's mentioned in there constantly. I mean, just a well-rounded guy. Great family too. I've been able to interview his family a lot, and they're super people. So
now, it may be this photo, but is he one of the few out of the group of that area of Texas that may have a little Hispanic in his family lineage, or is it just this photo gives him that appearance?
I think it's just this photo. His parents were from Alabama.
Okay.
So, yeah.
I mean, it would have made sense with the geographical location of the town and all.
Yep. And then Carl Sims, he has a pretty unique story too, and he's got an awesome family. His daughter and grandson have helped me with this a lot. Carl had never played sports before. And as you can see, he excelled at the arts. He was very big in choir and band, and in the newspapers, I found out that he had been chosen from the Valley as one of their top artists or, you know, whatnot. And forgive me if I'm wrong. I'm learning the arts through this project. So, he was very good at that. And the coach, Osborne Little, looked at him and like, this guy could be an athlete. And so he joined the team as a senior, and it ended up paying off.
Well, you got to keep in mind too, at the time, and even through the 60s, I mean, every adult in my family now, all my parents, my aunts, my uncles, they were all musicians. And back in this particular time in the 30s and 40s and even in the 20s, having a skill in orchestra, a brass band, was a potential way to support your family. You know, we didn't have computers to generate music. Radio was a new thing. And so you can get a gig jingles. You could play at the local orchestra. So learning an instrument was a reasonable expectation to at least have a medium level class vocation at the time. And so there's a tremendous amount of people who learned those skills, and sadly, you know, now it's a struggle to keep music departments going in schools these days. But back then it was typing and music. That was, you know, typing music or working with your hands. That's how you're going to possibly find a job outside of the farming and coal mining back in those days.
Well, and it's funny you mentioned that, because his job in the off season was working for the Rio Grande Valley Radio. So that was his job before going into the service. So, yep, that we're good here. And then we got Leo LaDuke. Leo was another one who his family was part of the early settlers in Weslaco, and he was vice president of the class, vice president of the athletic club, voted, I wrote there, most handsomest in his class. Very well known as well in his class, and his family too is phenomenal. And I like to give the family shout out, because like I said, I've asked numerous questions and they were so eager to help me, and his family actually supplied a lot of these photos that are throughout here. So
and this is a great photo. This is one of those photos that just goes to show, and I've said this on some of my podcasts, when it comes to fashion and style, those are the two industries that just rotate every 10, 15 years. And if you would have put this in color, put a HD Instagram filter on it, with it, you know, because that hairstyle, it's starting to die out again, but it came back for a while a couple of years ago, and I still have that now because of my living history. But you put a color Instagram filter on this, and this could easily pass as somebody's high school photo from 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah. And then we got Robert Suter here. Robert's family also was great with this, but he was born on December 6, 1924. And I want you to, at the bottom, you'll see his brother, James Frederick Suter, was killed or listed as missing in action on the USS Arizona on December 7th. So the day after his brother's birthday, which I'm sure installed a little bit of drive into him as the war wore on. He was an excellent track athlete as well. He was a mile relay guy, ran the 400 back then, it was the 440. Yeah, he was a good athlete as well.
Running the 440 and Chuck Taylor All-Stars. No art support. Just I know, right? Rubber. Go ahead, Dennis.
How did his, have you talked to his family at all?
Yep. Yep.
How did his parents feel about him going into the Marine Corps? I mean, was there any other kids in the family?
Nope. There was just he was the youngest of two sons, and I'm not sure. I know his dad.
Terrified.
Yeah, his dad died around the time that he went in, I think shortly before. So brother went, then dad went, and then he joined up. So it was, I mean, and his mom, I believe, remarried. So it was quite a process. But he also, one thing that Weslaco had at the time was they were in a cooperative called Texan, and Bob was an employee of that when he was a kid as well.
I saw that his brother was a radio man. Third class aboard the Arizona.
Yep. And then this is the youngest of the Weslaco 8, B.R. Guess. He's another 3-year varsity player and just a phenomenal athlete. He was known as Silent Guess. It seems to me like he was somebody that, he just did what he was told. His daughter and son have helped a lot with this project as well. And so this guy here was the stud of the football. They were all good. They were all fantastic athletes, all of these 8 guys. But this guy here, he was all over the newspaper, and we'll chat about that here on the next slide. So the 1942 football season, 6 of the 7 seniors, this is their final year. Harlan Black is in the back row, second from the left, right next to Glenn Kleckler. a lot. The only one missing in here is Carl Sims, but they were predicted to have an average season, and they flipped their record around going into the season. But I will mention too, number 81 in the front row.
I was just looking at 81. He's got a stellar pencil mustache.
Yeah, he was a starter. His name was Joe Garza. And I will mention, too, because I probably won't get to it later, but a lot of these guys went into the service after they graduated. And a lot of them followed the Marines because of what the 8 will do. Number 81 actually joined the Air Corps, and he went down in March, I believe, of 1944. He was killed as well. So Joe Garza was his name. But he was a grade below these other fellas. So, next slide.
At looking at this entire group and knowing that, you know, 8, possibly a few more that, you know, went to different services, but 8 of these cats went on to serve and to fight. Number 85, he definitely looks like he's either came out of the freshman class or like one of the youngest ones. I mean, you look at these, you look at these, this group, and a lot of them look like, you know, older, younger teens and young adults, but 85 really drives home the point of the age of these, of this group when this photo was taken.
Oh yeah. Yep.
They probably all went in, don't you think? I mean, they're the prime, they're in the fit of the fittest, and
yeah.
Yep. I can tell you too, we talked about Leo Ryan and being the oldest of 7 kids. The guy in the back row, next to Harlan Black, so it'd be to our left, so he'd be the first from the left in the back row. That is Kenneth Ryan. Kenneth Ryan was Leo's youngest brother. They were about a year apart. His interview is on the National Museum of the Pacific War website.
Wow.
His name is, and he specifically wrote in there that the main reason why he joined the Marines was because of what those 8 guys did. Wow. And he was on Iwo Jima as well.
Wow.
He was a part of the Joint Assault Signal Corps. But so here's the starting lineup, and we won't talk too much about this, but just to point out where the 8 guy or 7 of the 8 guys are. The left tackle is Bob Suter. The right guard is Leo LeDuc. The right end is Leo Ryan. Quarterback is B.R. Guest. Fullback, Harlan Block. And then the 2 halfbacks are Glenn Kleckler and Carl Sims. So 7 of all 7 started that year.
Wow.
And then this is their results. They went 6-2-1, and they had 7 shutouts. So, if, like I said, football, that means their defense went 7 games without allowing a single touchdown.
Wow.
And the 2 games that they did, they lost. So every other game, whether they tied or they won, they did not allow a single point scored on them. And by the end of the year, this is B.R. Guest running the ball. He scored 17 rushing touchdowns, threw for about 3 or 4, and he earned a spot on the All-Valley team as the top, one of the top players in the league.
Wow.
And this picture, and it's kind of hard to tell, but if you can see in the back, I mean, it looks like the crowd is just packed.
Yeah, you can see that.
And this is crowd, you know, sitting and standing on the field, and then maybe a few. Yeah. It's not like that you had a huge rack of bleachers back then, but yeah, it's very filled in.
And it was their armistice game, so that would have been game 8 at Donna when they lost 6-19. That was their, you know, every year they, and even at our school, they had the local November 11th game. And so this was their game, and they played the local Donna rivals and lost. But they were 6-2-1 and totally flipped that record around because it was the opposite the year before. And so January 1943, and the dates differ. I have done my best on research. And like I said, I've interviewed a lot of the families. 5 of the 8 families have, and their parents really did not talk about what happened during or after the war. So Glenn Kleckler was the one that lived the longest. And I won't get into too, you know, try and go off the rabbit hole here, but he was interviewed by the National Museum of the Pacific War as well, and he came up with the story that in January 1943, it was about the first war, from what he said, the first warmest day since the winter of